We're going to move to our next speaker. Thank you, Senators. We're going to move to Henrietta Holzman Foer, Administrator for USAID and Director of Foreign Assistance. She served prior to that as Department of State Undersecretary for Management. She is a businesswoman. She was a development official in earlier years with a special emphasis as Assistant Administrator for Private Enterprise and later for Asia. She has been a strong and loyal friend of CSIS over the years, for which we're very grateful, as well as the Aspen Institute. Welcome, Henrietta. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, and let me thank our departing senators, Senator Casey, for his moral and humanitarian urgency, as well as his help on appropriations, and for Senator Lugar, his comment about farmers and scientists as being a part of the human component of this crisis and its solution is a very important one that we will certainly take to heart. And may I thank John Hamry and Steve Morrison for their leadership. It's very important that CSIS and all of the task force members have brought up this issue and its importance to all of us. And may I thank the task force members. They are indeed a distinguished group and one that we have the great pleasure of working with around the world. The President has initiated a humanitarian and development assistance plan of action to address the most pressing needs in both the immediate and the near term. Within USAID and in discussion with our colleagues in other agencies, we have begun developing a longer-term strategy to more effectively address the underlying causes of the food insecurity. To address this global food crisis, we will need new ideas, but also a change in the way we organize and execute our foreign assistance. And I would like to highlight some of the elements of that developing strategy. Several recommendations from the report of this task force give us additional ideas to integrate into our thinking as we develop the strategy further, and we will look for even more. I know that my colleagues, Josette Sheeran, as well as Ambassador Pickering, will have additional thoughts, and we will incorporate all of these into our thinking. Fundamentally, as the report identifies, we must do a better job of linking humanitarian assistance, health and nutrition, agricultural development, and trade policy. This is a tough challenge. Developing a clear understanding of the linkages and breaking down stovepipes within and across agencies and uniting the perspectives of different partners who have often worked independently of one another in the past. We need to effectively manage these linkages and barriers. We need to do a better job if we are to make sufficient progress in reducing the ranks of the chronically poor and vulnerable. The report also correctly points to the inefficiency of our current emergency humanitarian aid systems. Beginning with our ability to adequately plan food aid strategies and interventions, we recognize that we must continue to improve upon our monitoring and early warning systems, our means for providing a timely and robust response, and we must strengthen the capacities of developing countries to do the same. To that end, we have recently begun to monitor urban food market prices to provide earlier warnings of emergency food insecurity among the urban poor. The President has advocated for greater flexibility in using local procurement to meet food needs more cost-effectively in support of local and regional market development. We applaud the report for taking this one step farther. Bold thinking about more effectively linking humanitarian and development assistance involves a reexamination of our efforts to assist the chronically vulnerable. Providing food aid year after year at an increasingly higher cost while underinvesting in longer-term solutions is inefficient and does not do enough to reduce the uncertainty and suffering facing millions of chronically vulnerable people each day around the world. We need to better understand when to deploy what collection of tools where the conditions are appropriate for growth-oriented agriculture, versus non-farm employment or safety nets. We will initiate a more extensive analysis and discussion with our partners and with Congress about how to tackle this problem, to identify truly sustainable and scalable approaches to moving chronically poor and vulnerable people out of extreme poverty. We must find more durable solutions by integrating nutritional, social, and economic safety nets with growth strategies. The global food crisis has deeper roots than just biofuels and poor weather. The historically low global stocks of most major food commodities and declining agricultural productivity growth over the last 15 years mean that supply is not keeping pace with demand. Obviously, we must invest more in agricultural development to reverse these trends and build more resilience in the global food supply to account for continued growth in demand and to address additional risks posed by climate change. We need to rebuild our internal capacity to target those investments. We cannot apply a one-size-fits-all approach to agriculture. The role of agriculture in economies and the relationship to food insecurity varies in different regions and countries around the world. And this is key. We need to capture the growing role of the private sector and markets in assuring food and nutritional security. Our analysis points to a fundamental impact that improved production of food staple crops has on poverty alleviation and food security in regions such as Africa. Over the past decade, investment in staple food crop production declined in importance in some circles of agricultural development, replaced by an emphasis in high-value, non-traditional exports. Yet experience shows that staple food commodities, both crops and livestock, produced and consumed by large numbers of people, are among the strongest drivers of poverty reduction. And to this fact, that the regional agricultural trade has such enormous potential, you have a winning combination. To reverse this decline, we are aiming high at doubling the productivity of key staple crops like rice and maize within 5 years, beginning in West Africa. This goal is ambitious but fully achievable. Staple crop production alone will not lead to full food security. We must also address nutrition through a multi-sector approach, which includes diversification of food production and consumption, and integrating our approaches to food, agriculture, and nutrition efforts more effectively. We also know that markets, rural and urban market chains, regional trade corridors, and global agricultural trade will continue to grow in importance in food security. Expanded market access and efficiency both increase the availability of food for the poor and increase the incomes of small farmers. Here again, we need to be bold and look at new approaches. One area I would like to highlight is expanding the financial mechanisms that encourage the dynamic growth of enterprises, insurance mechanisms to allow farmers to invest in productivity by cushioning risks, the larger scale agricultural credit systems to support agricultural processing industries and grain traders. Market development that links small farmers and the market will also depend upon infrastructure, better port facilities to import fertilizers more cost effectively, more widely available irrigation, and rural roads to move products to market. These are areas in which the Millennium Challenge Corporation has invested, and we will need to develop a more cohesive approach to foreign assistance, one that complements with other United States government agencies what they are doing, as well as what the World Bank and the United Nations organizations are working on. We welcome the task force recommendations in this area, and we need a new coalition, a new commitment of sustained interest in agriculture. We are still deepening our own thinking as we chart new directions in the face of the resurgent problems of high food prices and lagging agricultural growth. With the support of Congress and the global community to push our thinking to a much higher level, we must take action to scale commensurate with the problem, to address root causes relevant to each region, to truly integrate safety nets, such as food aid, with poverty reduction for the chronically vulnerable, to strengthen the capacity of countries to respond or to carry the response beyond our assistance, to unite the efforts of the whole United States government, to engage the private sector as a major part of the solution, to align donor assistance around common goals set through consultation with our partner countries. If we go back several decades to the late 1960s, it was one of my predecessors at the helm of USAID, William Godd, who coined the term the Green Revolution. I will not presume to be so eloquent as to name the next agricultural revolution, but I do know that this bit of history tells us that the United States once was truly the global leader in international agricultural development. All the evidence points to the fact that the time has come for us to lead again and to find durable solutions that are multidimensional and comprehensive for addressing the structural causes for the current crisis. So thank you to all of you and for the task force fine recommendations. Thank you.
Henrietta, thank you so much for your eloquent statement and your leadership, and thank you to Greg Gottlieb from your staff for his assistance throughout this process, and more broadly to Joseph Glauber, the chief economist and trade negotiator on agriculture, who was also very kind and generous in the time that he gave and advice that he gave to us. Our next speaker is known to all of you, I'm certain. Josette Sheeran is the 11th executive director of the UN World Food Program. She began her tenure in April of 2007 and has been at the center of the global discussion around the dimensions of the global food crisis and what to do about that. She brings a very strong diplomatic and trade expertise to this job, an exceptionally strong background. She was prior to coming to this post, she served as the U.S. Undersecretary of State for Economic, Business, and Agricultural Affairs, and served as a deputy U.S. trade representative prior to that. She has been indefatigable. This effort here really began as a direct result of her kindness in coming in April to a dinner discussion that we held at CSIS, and the day after that in a speech that she made as one of the Smart Power speaker series at CSIS, which drew over 250 people and much press interest. I also want to thank, while here, Ken Crossley, Jennifer Parmalee, and Mike Uznick from the World Food Program staff, who were so generous in what they did. Josette, thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, thank you, Steve. The World Food Program, as many of you know, is completely voluntarily funded. And on any given year, we have a responsibility to try to help about 90 million people who are in urgent need of an intervention to avoid the dire consequences of hunger. I've been in the post just over a year, and you quickly learn in this position that the first thing you ask is, who do I call when there are troubles? And I just want to say there are a number of people in this room who are really the backbone of the global response to hunger, including Senator Lugar's and Senator Casey, who have been so powerfully there as strategists and compassionate supporters of what we do. Also, Henrietta Fore, who's been a real leader and took this on and organized the first global discussion on the food crisis very early on. And I thank you for that. Ambassador Pickering, you have been on the front lines of all of these challenges. But I really want to thank CSIS for pulling this together. I think it is a fairly rare thing in the world to get action and advice quickly, in time, to meet the challenges that we have. And this report is really extraordinary, in my book, for its precision and its practical advice and its speed. And so I'm very honored to be here today to help kick this off. And I thank all of the NGOs and foundations and others that help, Bread for the World, David Beckman's here, CARE, and others who are our vital partners on the front lines of the hunger battle. I think these recommendations are not only strategically important, but also life-saving. This challenge cannot be solved without U.S. leadership. I've just been finishing the book, Guns, Germs, and Steel, which is basically a history of the world in pursuit of food security. And I think we're reminded when we see riots in Haiti and in many other countries that food security is so fundamental to the human existence that it's not only a humanitarian issue, but is perhaps the core security issue of our time. I'd like to talk about the only three questions that are really critical in my work. Where are we today? Where do we need to get to? And how do we get there? And why I feel this study really provides a roadmap. I think, as Senator Lugar said, we have a crisis and we have an opportunity. In a way, this is a wake-up call. The world needs to produce twice as much food by 2050, according to most estimates. It is a huge opportunity for some nations, and you'll see President Museveni of Uganda talking about the opportunity for Ugandan farmers. You'll see many of the South American countries talking about the opportunity to break the cycle of poverty. I see Ambassador Diop here from Mali, another country, looking for the opportunities that are presented here. But I think we have a 3 to 4 year period where before the market response can come to this challenge, where we will see a wide range of human suffering if we don't act quickly and with precision and also adjust our systems to meet the demands of our time. I'm always reminded about where we started, the founding of Food for Peace, the Marshall Plan, where the U.S. decided to take its abundance and really help those in need in the world and never asked the question if they were friend or enemy, but asked, is there a hungry child, and reached out across those borders. And many of you have seen this red cup. This is from our school program in Rwanda, many supported by the U.S. Congress through the McGovern-Dole program. And I take this cup around the world to illustrate how easy it is in one way to solve the hunger problem. Most people, most children just need a cup of food a day. It's humble, and it can revolutionize their life. And when I hold this cup up, I'm struck because ministers from Europe, Japan, Africa, and elsewhere often are moved to tears, not because only of the current situation, but because when they were children, they had a cup of food like this. And you see the hunger battle moves through history, from where my ancestors came from in Ireland, through Europe post-World War II, through Japan, and now nations that once were needy, even in just a generation ago, now are the backbone of helping those in the world who need it most. What happened with this food crisis is that for most people who have just the minimum amount of food every day, this cup began to empty in an aggressive way since last June of 2007. And so for the World Food Program, which is really just I call us the canary in the cave because we're working with the people who are most vulnerable, we were literally able from June of 2007 to January of 2008 able to fill this cup with 40% less food simply due to the price of food. And so right when people needed us most and many people were losing about half of their basic diet, we were able to reach about half as many people or with half as much food to the same number of people. I actually think we're in phase three of this crisis, and I just want to touch on this because I think it's important that we adjust to deal with the phase. I think the first phase was over the past 4 years, when, as according to IFPRI, the world began to consume more than it produced for 3 years running. And what we saw over the past 3 years, our countries draw down their emergency stocks and draw down their cash reserves to help support populations, thinking that this would not be a structural problem, but perhaps would pass with time. Starting in June 07, we saw the most aggressive pattern of price increases globally for food ever recorded. And it was about 10% a month, which then led to phase two of this crisis, which was really a humanitarian crisis, where reserves were drawn down and people were really put in a situation, as we saw in Haiti, reduced to mud cakes, or in Burundi, reduced to moldy cassava or other things as their purchasing power was cut in half. I now think we're in phase three of this problem, where if the World Bank is correct and these prices will stay with us into 2012, people and nations with little resiliency are going to need external help to adjust. And we're certainly hearing that from countries that are import dependent, have an additional shock, and are not the ones who are on the beneficiary side of being an exporting nation that can actually take advantage of the situation. I want to thank Henrietta, AID, the administration, the Congress, the Department of Agriculture for their extraordinary response. The United States put an additional $1 billion forward to deal with this crisis. And they're working with us on structural solutions, because today it's not just about whether or not we have the money to help, but actually procuring the food and getting it there in a timely manner has become a huge challenge. So before, where things were perhaps difficult to manage, we now have a real crisis in managing the global humanitarian food system. More than 30 nations have shut down their export markets, and if you look around Afghanistan, there's hardly anywhere to buy the food. This is true also in West Africa, where we faced a problem where we could not get to Liberia any food before October 15th. This is from all donors, even with cash, even with commodities, simply because we have to buy so far afield now. WFP used to put out tenders regionally, and all of them were responded to. Now we'll often put out tenders globally, and if we put out 12, we'll get response to 2 or 3. Very often our contracts are broken after they're signed, with the contract makers paying the penalty because they can get a higher price just 2 weeks later for the same lot of food. And so we need help in this situation with the kinds of specific recommendations that are in this report. And Steve, that's why I thank you for really the precision of the recommendations and the ability of us to respond to this need is critical. WFP has 80 donors and about 80 nations that we give to, and all of them have special regulations and restrictions on how we do business. And so this cross-cutting challenge really presents to us perhaps the biggest challenge of our 45 years. I'd like to just go quickly through these recommendations and why we think they're so critical. On the first, which modernizing emergency assistance, I think the key sentence is we need to improve the speed, agility, liquidity, and flexibility of the global food aid system. This is not just a challenge for the U.S., it's a challenge for the world. The best way to run this would be if we could pre-position in our humanitarian response depots 3 to 6 months of food that then could be distributed and accounted to donors upon distribution. But today, we typically have to follow donation all the way through purchase to delivery. So commodities are not commodities, but specifically must be tracked for accounting purposes from beginning to end. This is a almost impossible challenge in a world of greatly restricted markets. On doubling of the level of commitment, this is just a reality that we are in now. It costs today twice as much to run the World Food Program than it did a year ago today. There are additional people, but most of that cost is simply due to the doubling of food and fuel costs. Joachim von Braun, the leader of IFPRI, predicted in February that WFP would have to be 2 to 3 times its size before we got through this challenge. And at the time, I could not believe what I was hearing. And yet today, just 5 months later, that is where we are. On the recommendation of local purchase, we have urged, and we thank the administration for leadership, whatever the U.S. can do on this. The food is life-saving no matter what, but I will tell you, the miracle of allowing nations to help contribute to the solution of hunger themselves and the farmers in those nations is a very powerful long-term solution to hunger. I will just give you one quick example. Senegal is a food deficit nation, but it produces salt. Most of that salt that's iodized is for export, and the salt for local consumption is produced by many, many village producers and it is not iodized. They don't have the investment or the technology or the know-how to do so, creating one of the biggest health challenges in Senegal, which is goiter. WFP decided, with the cash donations that we get, to purchase salt for our local program from 7,000 village producers in Senegal, most of them women. They were able to get the investment to get the technology to iodize, and now all of the salt they sell locally is iodized. Plus, they have a guaranteed income from us, thereby breaking the cycle of hunger at its root. About half of the hungry we serve in Africa are farmers who simply cannot make enough regular income to even support their own families. So we urge any flexibility in local purchase. It is shown to be a powerful long-term development tool. Also, strengthening early warning. I think in an era of climate change, this is critical. We are told by experts that we will not know where the climatic erratic climate will hit. But we do know that everyone from farmers in America to wine growers in Europe and elsewhere are experiencing shifts as profound as a two-week shift in the planting and harvesting cycle. For farmers with the ability to tap research and know-how, this can be dealt with. But for farmers in Africa who are really dependent on centuries of wisdom that doesn't adjust to a two-week change in planting cycles, this could be a disaster without the proper agricultural outreach. So I thank AID and the Congress for focusing on the long-term solution. And I do also want to echo the recommendation on intensifying U.S. food security diplomacy. It has already had a profound effect. It's critical in the world. And you also make the point in the report that we have to encourage major oil-producing countries to contribute. And as many of you know, the World Food Program received from the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia $500 million, the largest single contribution ever in UN history, to deal with the food crisis. We think that kind of leadership is absolutely critical, and we continue to work with the oil-producing nations and all nations to help contribute to solving this problem. I also want to echo the call for more stable financing for WFP. WFP has no core budget, no predictability, and things like the adjustment in the recent farm bill for a longer-term commitment to school feeding or the flexibility given in pre-positioning stocks are absolutely critical. I think most importantly is the recommendation on enlarging social safety nets that can help build in the type of food security that will be critical in moving ahead. It's why WFP has shifted most of its work where possible to safety nets, such as in Ethiopia, and school feeding where appropriate. Many, many countries do not have food security infrastructures, and it is our goal to hand those over to nations, as we have with 36 different nations already. We feel this is a win-win situation that builds in a permanent flexibility. We thank you for your support for school feeding. We think school feeding is a win-win-win all around. It's one of the most powerful human rights programs for girls, virtually guaranteeing a 50% enrollment at least by girls. And if they're given an extra ration at home, girls in countries where girls had never gone to school will go to school at the cost of about 50 cents a week. And also, you talk about food for work there. I will say that the World Food Program, wherever possible, does not hand out food but works with communities on training and to rebuild communities. And in southern Sudan, we've been able to rebuild 3,000 kilometers of roads that were closed by exchanging food for training and for work. And with those open roads, farmers were able to get to markets, and we were able to cut back our general food distribution by half. So all of these things can be strengthened and can help countries in a practical way get through this challenge. We will need, however, to really come together globally to up the commitment and to adjust to get through this crisis and to ensure that nations that can benefit do benefit. I do want to echo Senator Lugar's call that we need a big idea. And I think at a time of crisis and challenge when the world has come together, it is time to think about eradicating hunger. We cost it out because Senator McGovern has said he will not rest until every child on earth has at least a cup of food in school. What it would actually cost to do so under our cost structures, and of course many, Bread for the World and others, do school feeding and nations themselves, but it would cost $3 billion a year for the world to say no child goes to school hungry. When filled with local produce, this helps also ensure a guaranteed income for farmers. This kind of revolution, where at least we can say no child goes to school hungry, is within our reach and actually would embed within this crisis the very solution that farmers around the world and others are looking for to break the cycle of poverty. I thank you, Steve. I thank you, John, and CSIS, and thank you for your leadership on this.
Thank you, Josette, for that powerful statement. Our last speaker is Ambassador Thomas Pickering. We were very eager in putting this program together to make sure that we captured the import of the foreign policy and diplomacy agenda attached to everything that we're talking about today. And I consulted with some of you here in the room as to who is the best person to try to capture what this means, what the implications are in terms of diplomacy and foreign policy strategies. And Thomas Pickering's name came up in every discussion, and we're thrilled that he has the time to be with us today. In his 50 years as a diplomat, he's left his imprint in many, many places and on many, many policies. He's been ambassador to the UN, Russia, India, El Salvador, Israel, Nigeria, and Jordan, as well as serving in many other senior-level positions, including Undersecretary for Political Affairs in the Clinton administration. Tom, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Steve, very much for your very kind introduction. Let me begin in reverse order of thanks and thank Josette very much for her articulate enunciation of the problem and the immediate need for us to begin to deal with it. Thank you, Henrietta, very much for AIDS response, which has been, as always, exemplary. And your leadership makes it, for me, a special pleasure to note that you've already laid out for us a good bit of how the U.S. will address the way ahead. Thank you, Steve and John and CSIS, for an exemplary report, concise, clear, and full of wonderful recommendations. And my thanks in their absence to Senator Casey and Senator Lugar for their lead up here on the Hill. Speaking last, Steve has told you he'd asked me if I would address some of the diplomatic issues. I won't do this in traditional terms because it's no longer time for that. We understand the problem in its depth. We wouldn't have an SRO crowd here on a quiet day in July if, in fact, this were not a problem that we were all impressed about, indeed its urgency and the necessity of dealing with it. That goes without saying. But I'd like to take up a piece of the problem which has been suggested but not yet, I think, put into the kind of concrete terms which are required for us to think about how to move ahead. And that piece is exemplified by the fact that U.S. leadership here is absolutely necessary. It is totally clear in the report. But what is also clear is that it's not sufficient, that indeed we must have the world community pay attention to this issue. The world community needs to be with us, and I believe the world community is ready to do so. Senator Lugar's simple idea is extremely important. Elimination of hunger sounds millennial, but as Josette has pointed out, it is within reach on a step-by-step focus basis, and it is partner to a twin of ending poverty, another increasingly important and serious goal in our interdependent and interchangeable world. How can we start on this issue? A huge challenge. Well, we have an opportunity. In just under 6 weeks' time, many leaders of the international community will be present in New York for the annual regular meeting of the General Assembly of the United Nations. I can think of no more important issue to discuss, and indeed, no more important focus for that group of leaders than to have President Bush, in concert with Secretary General Ban Ki-moon and with World Bank President Robert Zoellick, to call for a day, or if they can't spare a day, at least a half a day, to have a food summit, to focus on the issues which we now know are apparent and exigent and which must be dealt with urgently. This is not just a call for a meeting for traditional diplomatic blather. This is a call for a meeting that has an agenda. And indeed, the agenda is reflected in the report before you. Let me humbly suggest that this agenda should have three parts and should have three interrelated areas for solution. Part one of the food summit agenda ought to be what Josette has just talked about, what she has so ably led at the World Food Program. How can we deliver the immediate emergency food need that is required to prevent our sliding into much more significant levels of starvation around the world? It is clear that the international mechanism needs repair. It needs fine-tuning. And indeed, it needs inspiration. And I can think of no one better qualified coming out of the food summit to take on the task of pulling the nations of the world together, the UN machinery, and the private sector in delivering emergency food assistance than Josette. And I hope that this summit will take place, that agenda item number one will be emergency food assistance, and that we will see a focused emergency effort to try to provide that kind of a solution. Agenda item number two is also apparent and real and very significant. How can we, using present technology, present knowledge, present attributes in the world of agriculture, help the farmers, particularly in the impoverished tropical areas of the world, improve their production on as rapid a basis as possible in the face of the growing challenges of the competition for biofuels, in the face of climate change, in the face of new shifts in the area that makes farming one of the most difficult and challenging occupations known to man, but certainly one of the most important. So as you eat your lunch today, think about how and in what way we can help make that necessary added improvement in the short and medium term to real production around the world of that vital element for our own sustenance and our own survival. This means, in effect, pulling together a great deal of what we already know, everything from the philosophy of extension, which grew up and flourished in this country, to dealing with the introduction of new technologies in the face of cultural imperatives, things that we also and others around the world know well. I don't know who should pull this together. The obvious answer, of course, is something like the World, the Food and Agricultural Organization of the United Nations. It is a challenged organization. I would say to my old friend, its Director General Jacques Diouf, that they have a long way to go. But it is not time, obviously, to reform that organization at the same time we give it a major challenge. We need to be thinking about this. But some consortium of effort is required. Whether someone like my old friend, Lord Mark Malik Brown, who so successfully led the United Nations Development Program and indeed was Deputy Secretary General of the United Nations, might help to catalyze this, I do not know. He is doing official duty in the UK Foreign Office. But he would be the kind of individual that I would select to move this ahead. And if he can help motivate and lead the UN and other organizations to do it, I would compliment him and tell him that this would be the answer to a very significant part of the problem. And the third agenda item is a very simple one. You've heard it. It's the long term, the absolute need for us to put our scientific and technical resources to help to meet the challenge. A questioner a while ago talked about the network of international agricultural research institutions set up about 2.5 decades ago, in large measure with the help of the private sector, the Rockefeller Brothers Fund and others, helped to put together this consortium of roughly a dozen international research organizations. And out of one of those in the Philippines, with the work of Norman Borlaug, miracle rice developed, which led to the Asian Green Revolution. We now are, as ever before, challenged in the need to put science to work. So the third agenda item, in my view, is the agenda item of, again, coordinating, harnessing, expanding, funding international science to help us meet these urgent and emergent needs. New revolutions, in my view, are perfectly possible. Dick Lugar talked about the important contribution made through genetically modified activities. We need to find a way, working with our European friends on a scientific basis, to help understand what are the challenges, what are the opportunities in this area, because it is European attitudes that have affected attitudes in developing countries, while we, at least in this country, feel rather safe about consuming genetically modified produced crops. But we need to look at the answer to this. I don't want to predict it, but it's important. And maybe this is an area where our friends at the World Bank could help in pulling together a combination of the international institutions, of all of the state-run agricultural research establishments around the world. We have many in our countries. Of the absolutely marvelous university research systems that have been put together with the idea of making this a serious global push. And I hope that the leaders of the international community meeting at the UN this September would think seriously about helping to catalyze this process. Because without serious international leadership, without a serious international focus, it will move ahead, but not with the speed, with the efficiency, and with the effectiveness that we need to meet the problem. I have two other smaller issues, but they do also figure in this problem, and let me end briefly with a mention of those. Senator Lugar, I believe, mentioned the international negotiations on trade going on around Doha, and one of the key questions there is agriculture. Why isn't this challenge an opportunity for us to use the trade negotiations to think about the notion of how at one and the same time we can increase agricultural production and output and replace what I would call some of the malign subsidization that further distorts that sector and brings ahead what we would call a win-win in the trade negotiations and indeed in meeting the food needs? I don't think that's beyond the mind of man to formulate. I think it's an important challenge. Let us hope that those who are enjoying fine lunches in Geneva around the trade negotiation can think more broadly about this difficult problem. The third issue is also, in my view, very important, and it tends to have been overlooked, and that's the great issue of water. Agriculture without water isn't agriculture. Water is a growing problem around the world, and I could suspect that the next meeting we will have in this room to discuss a major challenge and indeed a pending tragedy will be about water. Water is critical. We need to think, too, about how to deal with that tremendously important question and how, in whatever way we can, pull together the international community to begin to deal with that problem, particularly, of course, and obviously in the arid parts of the world. But water is, in many ways, the lifeblood of agriculture. So thank you for these few minutes to take an opportunity to talk a little bit about ways ahead. I hope world leadership will accept this challenge. I hope the opportunity of a food summit in September in New York at the General Assembly will commend itself to them. It would be a good start on the long road to dealing with Senator Lugar's big idea. Thank you very much.